funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm very happy today to once again be facing Isabel Allende. Her new novel, Island Beneath the Sea, has been published by Harper. It's the story of a mulatto woman who was a slave and concubine, determined to control her destiny in a society where that would seem impossible. Isabel Allende is an internationally esteemed writer, still perhaps most famous for her first novel, The House of the Spirits. It is a pleasure to see you again, Isabel.
It is my pleasure, and thank you for having me, Michael.
It's a great delight. This novel takes place in Haiti and begins when?
It begins at the end of the 1700s, when the slave revolt started in what is now Haiti and was then a French colony called Saint-Domingue. And it's the story of a young slave, she's 9 years old, Zarité, when she's sold to a planter. And so the first part of the book happens in that colony, then the slave revolt happens in the middle of the book, and the whites had to escape. And so she follows her master to New Orleans. So the second part of the book, which is a very different tone and color and flavor, is in New Orleans.
Strangely and accidentally, both sections of the book take place in places that have suffered enormous cataclysm.
That is an eerie coincidence. When I started researching for this book 4 years ago, of course, Katrina had already happened. But I had visited New Orleans before Katrina, and I had an idea of what was the city before. And even with Katrina, it hasn't lost its spirit. Who could guess that there would be an earthquake? This book was already published in several European languages before the earthquake.
It's a historical novel about the adventures of a mulatto woman, Zarate Tete, who will travel from Haiti to New Orleans. She's born into slavery. The book explores many kinds of slavery: emotional slavery, physical slavery, economic and political slavery. The book takes Tete through many levels toward understanding what freedom is, and at first, freedom seems to demand the presence of a man.
More than slavery, or just as important as slavery in the book, are connections, relationships, family. The complications of a family in which the father is the master and is white, the mother is a slave and is African, the children are children of color. There is also a child that is white in the family. The privilege of the white child compared to the other children. The other children can be sold, can be given away, can be killed, it doesn't matter. And it's the same father. And this man has the obligation to emancipate the slave because she has saved his life, but he doesn't do it because he loves her. He depends on her. He has a connection with her, like he would have with his favorite horse, let's say, or with a beloved dog. He doesn't want to be separated from her. On her part, there is the dependency that all her life depends on that man and the life of her children. He's the only one who can protect the children if he so desires, but also the hatred of being abused and used like an object, like an animal, really. So there's this mixture. And then finally, there is a point when she's finally free. She has been free for a while, and he gets very sick. So he calls her, and he says, "I'll pay you. Just take care of me." And she says, "What? What is he thinking?" He never realized that the affection that he had for her, she did not have for him. He couldn't grab that idea.
And yet, there are times in the novel when she says to him, "Free me. I will still work for you.
Yeah, I will stay.
Give me my freedom."
Yeah. And he won't. And he won't because he's scared that she will go. And so by the time she gets it, it's completely against his will. He's forced to do it. He has cheated her into her freedom for many years. And so by then, she really hates him.
Now, I'm talking to Isabel Allende about her new novel, Island Beneath the Sea, published by Harper. It's in a form that was once highly respected, a kind of historical novel, even romance. Pearl S. Buck won the Nobel Prize. Edna Ferber, her books were widely admired, in addition to turned into movies and musicals like Showboat. Pearl S. Buck, of course, is the author of The Good Earth. Now the form has fallen into a kind of disrespect, and yet it was once one of the most popular and informative ways a novel had of telling its readers about a world that exists that the novelist has researched and is doing service by informing the people about the history of China, about the history of Creole New Orleans, about the world.
Although I think the author doesn't have that in mind, at least I don't. I don't want to teach anybody anything. I love the place and the time, and I just want to tell a story and entertain my readers. I want to tell them about relationships, about families, what happened in a family when there was slavery. The relationships were so complicated, and that is fascinating to me. Now, if the reader feels that he's learning something about it, well, that's very good, but that was not my intention. And you say that this genre has fallen into some sort of disrespect. What is now respected?
Well, you know,
in literature,
the literary more and more is a difficult novel to begin with that doesn't have a readership but earns gradually a readership over time, because people are eager to discover a new technique or a new voice. It seems to me that that is what the literary has become, and that the definition was at one time much, much, much wider.
Mm.
That we've lived in a culture that has made the literary into almost an arcane sect. Yes.
Yeah, a cult. But that's too bad, because then we lose readers. The more readers, the better.
I think so, too.
Well, I think the problem is that one starts writing for the critics. Most writers, and I include myself, are so scared of a bad review that sometimes we might compromise and start writing for the critics instead of for the public.
And who are your readers?
My readers are mainly women. They are getting younger as I get older. I go to a reading and I see these people that would be my great-great-grandchildren. I mean, they're in diapers and they're reading my books. And I get young men now because my books are required reading in high schools and in colleges and universities. So I get young men. I don't get older men.
What happened to me?
You're not an old man.
Oh. It's a very interesting thing, because in Island Beneath the Sea, one of the escapes that Zarete Tete, the heroine, has is to dance.
The drums, to dance, yes. And there's a sentence that she repeats. She says, I can't quote it exactly, but the slave that dances is free while she or he is dancing.
And that dance is a dance derived from voodoo.
It's derived from Africa. It's the rhythm of Africa. The slaves in the plantations had no instruments, so it was all percussion. It was drumming. Also, the drums was a way of communicating, because the sound goes far and fast. And so it was a language that everybody understood. And during the calendas, which were the voodoo practice, I mean, the ceremonies, they would start with the drumming. And the drumming and the dancing would make people fall in a trance. And the loas, the gods, would mount them. And so the practitioner had the unique experience of the divinity, of being the god, of being Legba, of being Ogun, of being Erzuli. And so they would get the attributes of the law and be empowered. And although when they woke up from the trance, they would not remember what happened during the trance, they remember the empowerment. And when these rebels, the slaves, went to battle against the troops of Napoleon, 30,000 men sent Napoleon, the best troops of Europe, they would face the cannons naked because they had the empowerment of the divinity. They felt invincible, and they felt that from the island beneath the sea, which was Guinea, paradise, the other world, the souls of the dead would rise and fight with them. So voodoo was a sort of glue that kept them together. They came from different places in Africa. Often they didn't share the same language or religion. But this spiritual force really gave them enormous power.
What interests me when I read about voodoo is how often the metaphors of possession, of being mounted, of the domination that creates a zombie seems simultaneously to reflect the system of slavery.
The zombie was a very interesting thing that I read a lot about how to make a zombie because I would love to have one. But the truth is that there has been a lot of research about that. And it seems that there are combination of plants, poison plants, that when given to a person, the person can appear dead for 24 hours. And so they bury the person, and before the 24 hours go by, that you have to get him out of wherever the corpse, apparent corpse is, and beat him up to get the circulation of the blood. And then the person is permanently drugged and usually has some brain damage after this. So that's the way they become like enslaved to somebody. But the worst, the thing that the slaves feared the most was to be turned into a zombie, because that meant that you could never, ever reach freedom. You could never die, and you could never reach freedom. So that was the worst kind of fate. But voodoo, I think that Hollywood has made voodoo almost an equivalent of zombies, which is ridiculous. Voodoo is a religion. It has one God, Papa Bon Dieu, and it has the laws that are like the saints in the Catholic Church, and it has a spiritual practice. I don't know why we're so afraid of voodoo. It's always identified with black magic, and it's not necessarily black magic.
It's like most things, feared and embraced, yeah, depending on who you are.
You find it in New Orleans, in all of the Caribbean, in Cuba, in Brazil, everywhere. And now more and more white middle-class people are joining the candomblé in Brazil, for example.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yes.
I had no idea. What is that like, then?
Well, I saw a couple of ceremonies, and very mellow. They sacrifice animals, but not in front of you. That's before. And then at the end, they may be barbecued, and the animals usually are chickens. And there is a potomitan, which is the tree trunk or a pillar that is the road for the loas to descend, or the orishas in Brazil. And there's drumming and drumming. It goes forever, very slow. And then the usually women, dressed in white, go in circles, dancing, until some of them fall in a trance. And when they fall in a trance, they are taken by older women inside, and they are dressed with the attributes of the orisha that has possessed the person. And so during the trance, she is the orisha.
I'm talking with Isabel Allende, author most recently of Island Beneath the Sea. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. Thank you. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking with Isabel Allende about her novel, Island Beneath the Sea, published by Harper. Now, you've become one of the world's most popular writers, and when you publish these books, people tell you things about the world that you hadn't known when you'd written them. I understand that you've learned things about slavery.
Yes. When I was researching the book, I was horrified, I mean physically sick, with the research, the idea of the horrible things that people with power and impunity can do to other people will make you sick, Michael. And it did make me sick. And then when I finished the book, I learned that today there are more slaves in the world than ever before in history.
Ever in history?
Ever in history. Even at the time when the economy of the world was based on slavery. Because today it's not based on slavery. It's only 1% of the labor force that is enslaved. But of course, the population has grown so much. So there are 27 million people that have been counted, but many more probably that have not been counted. And we are not talking only about little girls in Cambodian brothels. We are talking about whole villages in agriculture, mining industry, fishing industry, lumber, sweatshops that live in what is called debt bondage. There are also millions of children that are enslaved just in Haiti, which fought so hard to free themselves from slavery. The only slave revolt in history that has succeeded in Haiti today, there are 300,000 children from ages 5 and up who are domestic slaves, because the families cannot feed them. So they give them away or they sell them for nothing to families that use them as slaves and treat them worse than dogs. In Nepal, my foundation is helping a project that rescues little girls 7, 8 years old from the same thing, domestic servitude. Those are the lucky ones, by the way, because they could end up in brothels.
Now, these are not, as I understand it, people who are sold. It's not an economic.
There's no market, let's say, but they are sold. Before, people would buy a slave. Well, you could buy it from another family, but you could buy it in a market, and it had a value. And there were rules about the relationship of the master with the slave and the relationship of the society with the slave. Today, let's say that there was an investment of $1,000, $1,500. Today, they are disposable. You can buy a boy for 10, a girl for 20, a minor for nothing, and so forth. They have no voice. They are invisible. No country admits that they exist. And there are very few abolitionist movements.
You learned this as a result of writing a novel.
Yes.
Taking place at the end of the 17th century.
200 years ago.
Exactly. And about a woman who, on every level, at every turn, is seeking freedom and seeking to define freedom for herself and for her children, because she is the victim of rape by her master. The provenance of the children remains constantly uncertain. Mm-hmm. And a mother who attains freedom is perhaps, if lucky, given her child as a slave.
Well, yes. In the French colony, in what is today Haiti, a man could emancipate a mistress or a concubine or a slave, a female slave, and he could emancipate his children too. And so there was a class of free people of color called the affranchis, which were usually men, that the father had emancipated and given them some economic resources to get them started. And they were smart enough to make money. Some of them had plantations and businesses. They had all the trade. So there were the poor whites in Haiti, the civil servants, the military, the priests, who hated them because they didn't have political power and they were people of color, but they had economic power. So look, Michael, it was fascinating to research the shades of color, 60 shades of color, each one with a name, the difference in social classes, who tried to identify with whom, what happened during the revolt when all this got mixed up in extreme violence and brutality.
Now, in addition, there is a class of people, women, who are mistresses.
Yeah, courtesans.
And they are mostly mulatto?
They are all women of color.
All women of color, but of every shade of color.
Of every shade of color, women of color, and they are all free. And so they are independent. We would call them today call girls. So they go to the parties, they accompany the men. In the colonies, it was pretty much a male society because, of course, there were women that had come, but women didn't feel very comfortable, European women, in the colonies. Climate was horrible, mosquitoes and all kinds of diseases, plus a climate of terror because not only were the enslaved people permanently terrified and abused, but the whites were permanently scared that they would be poisoned or assassinated, and they feared a revolt. The slaves had been revolting always.
And the instability and the fear is marked at the same time by rigid and silent hierarchies.
Yes.
Of behavior, of management of people, and these hierarchies are in distinction to the actual rules, agreements governing the treatment of slaves, often agreements about treatment that are neglected.
Yes, there was something called the Code Noir, the Black Code, or in Spanish was el Código Negro, that was a set of rules about how the master could punish the slave, the hours that the slave had to work, the resting hours that they were supposed to give, etc. And, of course, they were neglected. There was nobody watching. And who would enforce them? The enforcers, amazingly, were usually people of color, free people of color. So the overseers were either high in the hierarchy of slaves or they were mulattoes that had been hired for that job. And they were brutal.
You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm talking to Isabel Allende about her new book, Island Beneath the Sea. Isabel, to what extent did you write the novel to explore the mixing of races and cultures and the consequences of that mixing, racism?
I was fascinated because culturally, for me, all this is a surprise. I come from Chile, where we did not have plantations and we did not have African slaves. We enslaved the indigenous people, but we didn't bring African slaves. And we say in Chile that we are not racist, which is a total lie. We not only are racist, extremely racist, we are anti-Semitic, and we are also, we have a system of class in which it's very, like castes in India. It's very hard in Chile to go from a lower class to an upper class. You may make the money, but you will never be accepted. And it's getting better now, but when I was growing up, I grew up like that, so I know. When I started studying all this for this book, I realized that racism is like the social class system in Chile. It divides people in absurd ways. There's absolutely no logical explanation. And in the book, I had to study the laws of the time, which changed because at the beginning it was a Spanish colony, then a French, we are talking New Orleans, a Spanish colony, a French colony, and then the Americans took over after the Louisiana Purchase. And then it was worse, way worse, because the American racist laws were implacable.
What fascinated me about the novel in its two places, Haiti, when it was known as Saint-Domingue, and New Orleans, is that they are all places where there are great complexities of culture which represent governments. In Haiti, half the island is Spanish, half is French. England
was attacking all the time.
Is lurking offshore. African culture has been imported in the slave trade, and it's the same mixture in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the French culture, the Spanish culture,
the African culture,
and the English culture.
And the English, yeah.
Yes. So that what we see in part two, I even began to think, because part two has a very different tone, and I thought of what Marx said, that history repeats itself, comic and tragic, or tragic and comic, that there was this sense in which wherever these people went, there was a repetition of conditions that they had hoped to leave behind. Is that still the world we live in?
I think so. In New Orleans, things were much better than in the colonies, that in the French colony of Saint-Domingue, much better. One of the things that made it better was that the United States was a slave nation, but they had abolished the trade, so you couldn't bring in slaves. They were sold in, it's ironic, the black market, by pirates in the Delta. And so the slaves became very expensive. They had to be well-treated. And people didn't look favorably at cruelty. It was a closed society. People were watching. In Saint-Domingue, cruelty was rampant. Nobody cared. These people were property. They were not really people, the slaves. So history repeats itself, and we commit the same horrible things against other people, no matter where. You know, when I researched this book and I saw the punishments and the horrible things that the owner of the enslaved people would do to the people they had absolute power over, and no one was watching, they were not accountable, I think of Abu Ghraib. I think of the dictatorship in Chile, of Auschwitz, of Franco and Mussolini, and everywhere in the world where there is power and impunity, we act like beasts. So I think that maybe societies have set up these rules so that we can live together, and religion is a way, or ethics, is a way of keeping us within certain limits, because we would do just anything if we were not held by certain rules.
I've been speaking with Isabel Allende, author most recently of Island Beneath the Sea, published by Harper. Isabel, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.